Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's July 6, 59 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. And it is a great morning so far for us here in Park City. We can expect to already see plenty of sunshine and very little cloud cover as we have high pressure really starting to take control of our weather. So far, we expect to see a high of 87 degrees today, of course, above average for this time of year, but it's summertime. What else do we expect? And tonight, we can expect to see another clear kind of night where we'll see very little cloud cover, if any at all. We'll see a low of 61, slight little breeze, really towards, 6 to 9 miles per hour. And going into Wednesday, we'll continue to see the sunny conditions continue for us, and we'll actually get warmer. We'll reach a high of 90 degrees on Wednesday under those sunny to mainly sunny skies. So it's going to be a hot one for us. Just make sure to take plenty of breaks in between. If you are outdoors and drink plenty of water going on into Wednesday, we can expect to see mostly clear skies and a high low of 65 degrees for us. And we continue with the heat on in Thursday, seeing a high of 91 with some southeast winds blowing a little bit, becoming on the breezy side. And then we'll continue into Thursday night with partly cloudy skies and a low of 61. As we go into Friday, we see the movement of a dry cold front bringing in some cooler temperatures, but again, cooler compared to the midweek, where we'll see a high of 84 on Friday with sunny skies, mostly clear conditions also for Friday night as we drop our lows to the 57 mark. And as we go into Saturday, we'll continue with more sunshine. Again, that high pressure still sits over us, and we'll see a high of 87 degrees, mostly clear skies. And as we continue into Saturday night, we'll see a low of 59. Sunday, we continue seeing some temperatures around the upper 80s for us, and that leads us into the next work week where we see plenty of sunshine for us. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
Okay, thanks, Cesar. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Then the Director of Marketing and Events for Canyons Village Management Association, known as the CVMA, Dave March, with details on this summer concert series. It starts on Thursday. They have concerts on Thursdays and Saturdays. He'll also have an update on the workforce housing that's now under construction. Finally, Cheryl Fox, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, with an update on some open space issues and events they've got coming up. The Summit County Council will be interviewing applicants Wednesday for vacancy on the Snyderville Basin Recreation District. That before moving into a closed session, then reopening with a work session starting at about 1:30. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you this morning?
Doing great, thank you. So let's see, about 1:30 Wednesday, Dakota Pacific returning to the County Council, set for a two-hour time block. Earlier this year, as we reported, the project was sent off to various subcommittees who were looking at elements like transit and affordable housing and more. It looks like the major update is that we've returned to the Dakota plan that was originally before the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, and that includes developing what are now county-owned properties so that a transit center, a civic center, perhaps a county museum, a performing arts center, and a senior center can be added. Have we worked out those county land exchanges?
Well, what the big question was when we went into this, I guess you'd call it a committee process or charrette process, is was there going to need to be land trades involved in anything like this, or could the county develop its property by itself or in conjunction with other developments that were going on? And what we figured out is that, and you're going to hear this tomorrow afternoon, is that we don't need to do any land trades. Dakota Pacific could move forward with a change to their development agreement and do the things that they need to do on their property, and the county could move forward with its property. And that also includes all of the range of different types of transportation improvements that are being pursued around transit, roadway, and parking.
So I fill in some of the blanks here. Does that mean that Summit County then has to build its own transit center, civic center, senior center?
Well, I mean, if you look at those types of things, you know, transit centers, the different proposals that are in front of UDOT in regards to roadway improvements, they're going to take quite a bit of different kinds of money, state, federal, local, in order to bring those about. And so it, you know, and those benefit all of Kimball Junction and really all of the region. It's not just Dakota Pacific that is responsible for bringing those things forward. And you know, at the end of the day, those are public operations. If you're talking about transit. So, I think it's important that the county within this total concept understand how its property is going to interact with an overall development that's going to happen around it or could happen around it.
So the deal, though, I mean, these were some of the benefits, so-called benefits, that the developer was proposing, you know, to kind of sweeten the deal for them. So what benefits are we getting from the developer now?
Yeah, I don't really think that's the case, that the developer was saying that the overall, you know, big picture transportation improvements that need to happen in the area are the benefits of the Dakota Pacific project. I think that the project probably is going to have a big contribution to those things from a dollars perspective. But at the end of the day, a lot of these improvements, whether they be a county facilities or an improved library or certain transportation improvements, those really are public responsibilities. An enhanced development around Dakota Pacific and then other redevelopment in the area will contribute to that. There are financing mechanisms that probably would get put in place around this area to help contribute to that, as well as leveraging different forms of money at the federal and state level.
So what are the benefits then that the developer is providing, I mean, besides the density?
Well, I mean, you know, if you're speaking specifically about, you know, they have an open space obligation that they have to contribute to within their parcel. Some of that has already been done as part of the overall Boyer Tech Park that was originally entitled. They're proposing more, and you're gonna see an additional. You've already seen, and you will see more affordable housing talked about. I would say those are the two largest benefits. But there's other benefits that they're proposing that they will participate in, including the financing around local share of large transportation projects that you're going to hear talked about. And those are the benefits that do come from this look at this development agreement.
So you say more affordable housing, but the numbers look like what we've seen before. We're talking about 1.3 million total square feet of development with 1,100 residential units and about 300 units of affordable housing. So where's more affordable housing going?
Well, I mean, I don't feel it's my job to defend or look at the benefits and judge those with Dakota Pacific. But you'll recall that the Boyer Tech Park built their affordable housing obligation up front before any other part of the property was developed. So that entitlement already has its affordable obligation done. So anything more that's produced from that development agreement or a redo of that development agreement is more than its original obligation. So I think it's important to remember that. Now, how that mixes into the total judgment of the council on this project, that's for them to decide.
All right, and we're talking about the Liberty Peak Apartments, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. In the packet, it does say some sections on land use or affordable housing just say, quote, information to be inserted later. So when do we see this information?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this is an ongoing conversation. And so we're Dakota Pacific and staff and the council members that were involved are coming back to talk about what has been produced so far. We'll get some reaction from the council, and I'm sure there'll be more more meetings to discuss how we move forward.
Does Summit County have a plan to improve traffic circulation at Kimball Junction?
I think there's many levels of government that have plans in order to improve circulation. You know, you've heard us and we've been aggressively pursuing bus rapid transit. We expect to, we've just put in place the High Valley Transit System, which is, we believe, a great improvement already to circulation of the area. And then, of course, you've got UDOT that has been working on an overall plan for 224 and its connection to I-80 and the local roads that cross 224 that tend to have an effect on traffic circulation in the area. They're working through their process, which the next step is to, get to a locally preferred alternatives that can then go through the environmental process. Those are all very active steps towards getting to projects that can be done. First you have to figure out what you're going to do, then you have to figure out the financing around that, and then we pursue it. And these things are items that are going to be 10 to 15 years in the making.
What would you like to get from council then following tomorrow's discussion?
Well, I mean, I think it's really up to the applicants to decide what they want from council. We're trying to interact as much as we possibly can and then bring that back to a public discussion so that people understand what is being talked about. And then, I think at some point the Dakota Pacific folks are going to have to call the question from the council and see whether the council wants to move forward or not.
All right. Let's see. There's also up for discussion the sheriff's office deputy pay plan. There were no details in the staff packet, so can you kind of let us know what this is about?
Well, if you've been reading news, and I'm not trying to belittle this, but it is a big deal that across our country, it's hitting us locally. It's very difficult to recruit and retain law enforcement officers these days. Utah is not unique in that. We've had a couple of agencies stand up in the last year, which are kind of diluting the number of people that we have in the state available to work in law enforcement. Plus, a lot of people have gotten out of the business in the last year. I think the sheriff is looking at how can we enhance the experience here in Summit County to be a Summit County Sheriff's Deputy. And one of those ways is to look at how quickly officers move through our pay range. At this point, I think it takes somewhere more than 10 years to move from the bottom of the top of our pay scale. There are agencies in the state that are more aggressive than that, and we have to compete with that. So the sheriff is looking at that constantly because he's the closest to having to do that recruiting and retaining, and he'd like to propose some changes to the council.
So in addition to perhaps making it more aggressive, getting to the top of the pay scale quicker, are we also talking about increasing the top of the pay scale?
Well, I don't think that's going to be looked at this point, although I haven't seen the exact specifics either. I think we're also in the process as a county, and this is countywide, not just the sheriff's office, of doing a salary survey to prepare for our 2022 budget process. I think we're going to be looking at those pay ranges in that process, which might get adjusted in the 2022 budget.
All right. Also a discussion about grants that the county expects from the American Rescue Plan Act. Some funding you just received. Some funding could come as late as 2026, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's the world of the American Rescue Plan is a very variable world right now, and we've got to keep a close eye on it. As you'll recall, the county itself got allocated about $8.1 million, which comes in two tranches, one this year, half next year, has to be spent by the end of 2024. We're working on those dollars and looking for the opportunities to leverage those into more than $8.1 million towards county priorities. But then there's a whole host of different grants that are coming to the health department specifically. These dollars seem to have a lot more, I don't want to say constraints, but they have a lot more specific purpose in mind, depending on the dollars. I think it's important for the council to understand how those will affect our future budgets, because there's some of these grants that require us to, if we accept them, to hire staff, you know, so that has an effect on our chart of positions. You know, since these are grant dollars, we have to be careful about how we hire people so that we're not creating permanent positions that then we have to figure out how to fund programs and people in the future. If they're dollars that don't continue, then those are programs that wouldn't continue after those dollars are available. So we're just starting that conversation and making the public and the council aware of what is coming our way.
Yeah. And should we just not count on receiving that? I mean, gosh, we could have an entirely new administration in 2026.
Well, I think that's the way we generally approach grants, is that we really try and not create bureaucracy around things that we are not sure whether they're going to continue. A lot of these grants that we're seeing right now tend to be a reaction to the pandemic, that are hot topics today. But as we all know, that doesn't mean that they're going to be a hot topic 2 years from now.
All right, let's see. The council also will also consider possibly adopting a zone change to approve the proposed mountainside storage along Highway 248 in the Camas Valley near Democrat Alley. It looks like the staff is recommending approval here.
I believe they've been recommending approval since this project first came forward from the Planning Commission. I also believe the Planning Commission recommended approval. The council has heard from the applicant a couple of times. They've done a site visit. And the last time it was discussed, the council told the applicant that they'd bring it back one more time for a final discussion. So that's what's on the agenda today.
Okay. Let's see. Wanted to ask you, given that we've talked with the mayors of Oakley and Hanifer about the need that they've had to put in building moratoriums, is that anything, given the kind of just the water worries we have, is that anything that Summit County is going to be looking at?
Well, Summit County looks at it in a different way. You know, we're not the only place that we're kind of a water provider is that we have a special service district, Mountain Regional Water, that services customers within the Snyderville Basin. And so, you know, from the standpoint of development, you know, we don't provide water through a system. We look at the relationships that, you know, Basin Water companies have under concurrency with Weber Basin Water. We have systems in place that if a project comes through the process, it has to prove that it has wet water in order for it to progress. That has not been an issue at this point. Now, where we are looking at water restrictions is in our codes, especially within landscaping codes and building codes, to see if there's ways that we can get past just encouraging but requiring different types of water use to reduce both culinary and secondary water use.
Now, we used to have a water concurrency officer on staff. What's happened to that position, and do we need to bring it back?
We actually contract for that position now, so it's not gone away. It's just not a full FTE, and we are very active in water concurrency still, and the water companies hold us to that. We are kind of the organizer of it. Certainly, it's within our health code. The water companies all participate because they all have an interest in the overall relationship with Weber Basin Water.
All right. And so NF Mountain Regional felt like they really couldn't accept any more water connections. Would they have the authority, or is that a county council decision to not accept that water connection?
Well, it's probably both. And, you know, it also starts to kick in other parts of the agreement with Weber Basin Water about developing more water source. So it's more than just looking at it from the development perspective. It's also looking at it from the source perspective, which starts to get into large projects, large dollars, and large community conversations about how that is all paid for, because in the end, rates will go up if we run out of water.
All right. Finally, just wanted to ask you about the decision Summit County made back in June to celebrate the new federal holiday, Juneteenth. Did you hear back from anybody in the community about that kind of last minute decision?
Certainly internally we've had some discussion about it, because it, you know, the result of doing a holiday like that when you don't have everybody that works 8 to 5, where you have 24-hour shops, different shifts, and you have some work that just had to happen on that day anyway. We've had some internal wrangle over that from a pay perspective, but I have not heard anything back from the public, either positive or negative. It was an opportunity to honor that day, and I think it will get more solidified over the next few years about how that's going to be handled. And of course, we'll plan for that within our budget process next year. Not knowing yet whether that means we add a holiday, whether we take another holiday away from somewhere else in order to keep the same number. We'll deal with that during our budget process.
All right. I guess what I had heard was that there were a couple of real estate closings, more than a couple, scheduled for Friday, and four realtors actually had no notice, or at least didn't get any notice out to their members. And again, any other time when a holiday is expected, that's not a big deal. But given that people didn't know about it, closings had to be at the last minute postponed. And I guess there weren't many problems, but definitely a lot of ball juggling going on.
I can certainly understand that. That we didn't have any notice that the holiday was going to get declared mm-hmm. by the federal government. We reacted to it very quickly. It was my call in order to take that holiday or not, and I chose to go away, and we attempted to get as much word out as possible before the end of the day, but we were dealing with that within about a 3-hour period before the close of business that day, and certainly understand the impacts of that. I'm apologize for anybody that was negatively impacted. But it was important that for our organization to acknowledge that.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I have nothing else today.
Okay. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Starting this Thursday and running through the end of August, the Canyons Village Summer Concert Series returns. In the studio with me is the Director of Special Events and Marketing for Canyons Village Management Association, Dave March. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
Hey, first just wanted to bring up the fact that there were some pictures circulating about Saturday night's concert packed. Just packed. I don't know if you were around for that. Are we not limiting the numbers? No COVID precautions in place?
We are not. Both CVMA and Park City Mountain are following, you know, the existing CVMA and county rules. So we are outside and more or less back open to public. So no capacity.
Okay. Let's see. How many concerts have you got planned then? Because you're holding both Thursday and Saturday mm-hmm. night concerts?
Yeah, the Canyons Village Summer Concert Series is 14 shows, so not including July 3rd, which you said was this past Saturday, which was a great one, re-entry back into the events world, which everyone was excited about, even without fireworks, but 14 in the concert series. There are two dates in the middle of July, the 22nd and 24th, where we've got some really big annual group business. Otherwise, we would have probably 16.
Okay. So start time is when?
6 o'clock.
All right. And people can start getting up the mountain when?
We have the cabriolet opening at 5, so folks can park down there if they're not already on campus. That opens at 5, and concerts begin at 6, free and open to the public as usual.
Okay. And what are the rules you want to go over?
Basic rules, no outside alcohol, blankets and picnics are welcome. However, you know, low back chairs just for the courtesy of others, no dogs, no umbrellas, and those are more or less bring a smile, have some fun, enjoy the lawn, and listen to some live music.
Yeah. What is the capacity?
We don't actually have a hard cap based on the typical flow, but, you know, we can fit a few thousand folks comfortably in there, whether it's the grass or the hardscaping or the umbrella bar in some of the restaurants. So it's pretty fun. Usually we see, you know, folks coming a little before 6, and then they stay until 7:30 or 8 when the music's off, and then they can head on down the cabriolet or head back to their rooms.
Okay. I noticed on Thursday, July 15th, mm-hmm. we've got Park City's Wyatt Pike scheduled. Any others that you want to highlight?
We are excited about that. We're getting a lot of requests about him, and I would say that, you know, normally our Saturdays obviously are bigger than the Thursdays, but he might be the near the top of the list this year. But we're excited. They're a great one. Hot Buttered Rum, I'm sure some folks know. Freddie Jones Band was out of Colorado. They were a fun one when I was in college. We have Ico, which is a great one. And then on August 14th, a band called Turquoise. They've done some work with Talking Heads and some others, Bonnaroo, and some big festivals. So we're excited to bring back our kind of national and regional talent to Park City.
Okay. And in terms of getting the cabriolet, people up the cabriolet, I mean, how many can you get up in an hour?
I know, it's a great question on the hourly, but it's eight people per cabin standing, and it's about, geez, three and a half minute ride. So the uphill capacity is pretty quick.
Okay. And if people wanted to avoid the cabriolet mm-hmm. and get on a bus, do you know what bus line people take now to get to the village?
Yeah, obviously we just integrated last week on the 1st with High Valley Transit, and that's been going really well for us. So you can connect in from anywhere in Park City, anywhere in the county. We as CV May actually have between 100 and 200 spaces out at the Ecker Hill Park and Ride. So we recommend anyone coming up from the Salt Lake area, they can just jump on those buses and come on in the electrics as well. And then High Valley Transit within Canyons Village with this new integration service, we have every 15 minutes there's stops from the Frostwood area by Waldorf, the transit hub, and then also up at the Upper Village stop by the Grand Summit and the Westgate and the hotel. So quite a bit of opportunities on public transit, as well as the Summit County e-bikes. We have a big e-bike station right there at the Canyons Village Transit Hub, and then anyone obviously staying in the building just okay. walking over.
So the express bus, though, just gets you to the base of the
right,
cabriolet.
To that transit hub. Mm-hmm.
So is there then a bus from there up?
Yeah, every 15 minutes there is the new shuttles. I don't know if it's 18 or if it's about a 27 passenger, but those new ones go every 15 minutes. That's great for us.
Okay, but not the big buses.
Correct. Those are no longer part of the service with High Valley. Instead of every 30, these are every 15 minutes, and they actually now take you over to Frostwood in the Waldorf area, which was not part of the county before. So a little bit more efficient, part of their kind of micro rollout, but it's been great. We've seen them, you know, all day, and I think it's 6 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Okay. Anything else you want to let us know about the concert series?
No, we're excited, and we're happy to have everyone back and come on out and enjoy some fun.
Okay. Again, Thursdays and Saturdays, 6 p.m. is when the show starts. Mm-hmm. Cabriolet opening up at 5. Let's get an update on the 1,100-bed workforce yeah. housing. We had a groundbreaking, of course, earlier this summer.
We did. June 7 was the groundbreaking. Building permits have been issued, and we are off to the races. So over 1,100 units. There's 789 bedrooms over 7 buildings. Excited about that. The hope would be, you know, late fall 2022, the first one or two buildings would be open with the full project being done by Christmas or so of 2023.
Okay. Can you explain how this is working? I mean, is this a CVMA project?
It is, yeah. As part of our development agreement with Summit County, we have a responsibility once we hit certain thresholds of build-out, the first really being 30%, which we've now hit, to create employee housing. So great public partnership and private with the county, with Columbus Pacific, who's the developer, and certainly with CVMA. So, yeah, it's a CVMA project to the benefit of everybody. So, you know, Park City Mountain to the Waldorf, to the Westgates, to any of the big hotels. Kind of a tiered threshold in terms of eligibility. Some of that will be published here in a bit, but, you know, really you have to be a full-time Canyons Village employee first, then it'll kind of step down into part-time, and it eventually extends out into Summit County if there is even a demand for that, but we're very excited about it.
Oh, okay. So you said that'll be rolled out a little bit later, but mm-hmm. we're talking, so what about folks that work on the Park City Mountain Resort side, they would also be eligible or no?
Potentially. There's a kind of, I want to say, 4 to 8 types of eligibility requirements. But full-time, year-round in Canyons Village, then there is a kind of a next step of part-time. So, example, yeah, a resort employee that may work on both sides, they have to qualify potentially a certain amount of hours, and then moves on down. But we're expecting, you know, real exciting capacity and whatnot throughout the entire winter, and then hopefully, you know, seeing the same in summer with Canyons Golf. Obviously, our hotels are open, and the employees that are, you know, needed to run the, you know, all the different amenities within the village.
All right, so we're talking again the folks that work at the hotels, not just lifties and
correct. Yeah, it's a Canyons Village management collective project, so not just Park City Mountain or not just a Westgate, for example, some of the bigger ones. So it's any employee that qualifies within our specially planned area.
So this has got to be a multi-million-dollar project. Where does CVMA get the funds?
It is. Some of the funding is through through some work with the county, and then the developer is doing some of that as well. But I don't know quite exact enough of the detail to speak to that. But certainly Tom and Brian Madassi, who's our president, could speak to that a little bit better. But it is a great, unique relationship between the county and CVMA in terms of the funding models.
Okay. So let's see. Again, we could have folks in there as early as a year from this fall.
Correct. Yeah, exciting. And right on the transportation routes with High Valley Transit, obviously we're next to the Cabriolet, and then in the winter, you know, CVMA still manages Canyons Village Connect, which is the free intra-village service on demand all the way around the village. So right there, there's some future commercial spots that aren't included in this initial build that will be also part of that parcel. So we're excited about that. CVMA, we're hoping to potentially move our offices over there as well. So a lot of exciting pieces over there.
So CVMA is financed how?
We have, four different assessment types through our members. We have a retail assessment. We have an overnight, basically an overnight room tax, the TOA there. We have an annual transfer fee on real estate purchased and sold, and then there's an annual assessment relative to each land or unit parcel. So between those four, we are funded that way, and one of our obligations within the county in our original development agreement is employee housing, so we are off to the races.
All right, and certainly it's being built there in the parking lots there at the base of the Cabriolet. How many parking spots are we losing?
We don't lose any. We're a separate parcel, so it's unofficially been kind of an overflow parking for the Cabriolet, but the resort maintains their parking units within TCFC, the master developer's land, so this is actually separate from that. This has been a CVMA parcel from day one. We've just kind of added this on bigger parking days, so it doesn't do that. And then within our parcel, we do have a few hundred spots within the parcel for those that are living there, but you know, as you'll see, you won't need a car. I mean, the whole thought here is transportation, removing single occupancy vehicles and making it a lot more efficient for those on site.
Okay. I mean, is that going to be a requirement? I mean, that somebody has to, if they had a car, they would have to pay extra perhaps in rent?
Yeah, it goes into the kind of onboarding process when they're looking at that. So they have to note that. And I believe there's a value add on the an uptick in the price point, but I'd have to double check on that one.
Yeah,
we're not pitching parking, but there is a minimum requirement obligated within the project.
Certainly, and many kids that come from other areas of the country tend to have a car to get themselves here. So is this really for our J1 workers?
Yeah, but I think you're going to see a lot of full-time. I mean, some of our units are some bigger townhomes for that, you know, manager director level with, you know, husband, wife, and a few kids. So I think, you know, we're expecting this to be more than just the specific J1 seasonal folks. So I think we'll have a real demand for, you know, for the ability for all those in town looking to, you know, retain and keep quality employees. I think it's going to be great. You know, parking is a small component of it, but, you know, pitching the ability for access on all these public transportation offerings just, you know, a few hundred yards away is a game changer for us.
Okay. Would they be able to park there at Ecker Hill and take the bus in?
Mm-hmm.
Have their vehicles there?
Yeah, I don't know about overnight parking exactly. I would probably think not. But there'll be a pretty thorough vetting process once they go through that application process.
Okay. And again, you expect people there year-round?
Correct.
As opposed to just Yeah,
we're excited. I think, I mean, I don't know exact numbers off the top of my head, but, you know, it's anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 employees year-round between, you know, front desk and back-of-house staff, between hotels and the resorts, and I think there's going to be quite a demand that, you know, we'll have some great usage all year-round.
All right, and then who manages all that?
We are going through a property manager right now, but that'll be decided here soon. Folks that have background in employee, you know, in affordable housing projects, but we're getting pretty close on that one, too.
Okay, anything else, Dave?
No, I think that's it. Hopefully everyone comes out. Have a safe summer. Thanks for everything everyone's doing in town, and we're excited.
Okay, Dave March, thank you for your time. Joining me now on the phone from Summit Land Conservancy, Executive Director Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
So let's start with the public hearing that's coming up July 14th. This is the Wasatch Open Land Board. What's happening?
That's right. So the Wasatch Open Land Board is a committee that was seated by the Wasatch County Council, and their task is to figure out how to spend the $10 million bond that the Wasatch County voters approved back in 2018. So they've seen a couple of projects come through and have approved a couple of other opportunities to save land, including the Summit Land Conservancy's project to save the Mountain Spa, which we hope will be completed later this month. But one of the other projects is being proposed actually by Heber City, and the plan here is to add an open space component to an existing park. It's Muirfield Park, which is on the west side of Heber City. And the idea here is to acquire about 14 acres of land that is currently used for pasture. There's a creek that runs through it. And basically just to create a sort of open space, some trails, not a developed park, but really an open space park. So that the idea is that the land would look the same as it looks today. Maybe there could be some, you know, improvements, some trees and things like that. To the property. But anyway, the city of Heber has gone to the Wasatch Open Land Board to ask for help in funding the acquisition and permanent preservation of this open space parcel.
Okay, which is privately owned, is that it?
It is privately owned now. Actually, there are two landowners. So the city of Heber is going to buy it from these two landowners if they can find the funding.
Okay, so you're just asking people to support it, or...
Well, we think it's a good idea, you know, but we really think that it's important that there is a public process here, and that the voters in Wasatch County who approve the bond and who will be paying the, you know, increased property tax for the bond should probably weigh in on that.
All right. So this is about $350,000. Again, $10 million to go. How much is left of that? $10 million.
You know, our Mountain Spa project was going to take $300,000, but we're now, we've been able to increase the support from our secondary buyers. So in that, we're asking only for $200,000. So, and then the other project that the Wasatch Open Land Board has approved is the purchase of a conservation easement on the Kohler Dairy. And that has not, I don't think, been finished yet. And I'm not exactly sure how much money they were putting in on that.
Okay. You've got a number of events happening in July, so I'll just let you run through them.
We do have a lot of ways for people to join us outdoors. We have a moonshine owl prowl with Hawkwatch International. So this is we call them our moonshine adventures. People come out in the dark. They meet at 8 p.m. That one is on July 23rd, and we're going to go up Daly Canyon and look to see if we can find some midnight raptors, if you will. One of the fun things about all of our summer activities is that we do partner with other organizations. So that one is with Hawkwatch International. The second is our nature bathing, which we are continuing from last year. This is with Communities That Care. And this is a meditative, I know Leslie, you've been on one of these hikes, at least one, a meditative, different kind of experience out in nature. I just finished reading a book called The Nature Fix, and it was all the science behind why we feel better when we go outside. And whether that's the scent of the pine trees or the fresh air or the silence. There's just a whole host of things that make us feel better. So nature bathing is on July 27th. That's going to go at 6 p.m. And we are hunting for hops on July 14th. That will be at 6 p.m. And then our partner there is, of course, Wasatch Brewing, who makes our clothing optional after the hops grow and we harvest them. All of these events are free and open to the public, but we limit them to 20 people because otherwise it's just kind of too many people on the trail. So we ask that people please go to our website, wesaveland.org, and sign up. And you can get all the details there. And then you can also see the events that are happening in August.
All right. And then you've also got an annual gala that you've happened, but you're kind of reconfiguring this?
That's true. We have had our annual summer fundraiser up at the Blue Sky Ranch for, I think, 5 or 6 years in a row, and they were great hosts. But we had to make a decision in February about what we were going to do, and at that point, it just seemed like people might not still be ready to go to a big mass gathering indoors. Maybe they are, but anyway, we decided that we would have essentially a fabulous outdoor experience on the March at Meadows, which is the property that we purchased last year. And it's right on the Weber River. There are big cottonwood trees. There's a heron rookery. It's just an incredibly beautiful piece of property. So we hope that people will come out and support our work. Early bird pricing on tickets ends tomorrow. So I'd encourage people, again, go to the website, wesaveland.org, and you can buy tickets right there.
Okay, tickets are going for how much?
They're $300 for early bird and $350 if you wait.
Okay, and what does that include? Are you going to have some food and drinks? Or?
Yeah, we're having a really sort of interesting upscale picnic, and there will be some music. This event, however, we wanted it to be really sort of unplugged, organic, and in person. There will not be a screen anywhere on the property. So we hope that people will come out and, you know, it will be a little bit quieter than the usual Blue Sky Bash. But I think that's why we're calling it Magic in the Meadow. I mean, it is really, again, kind of a restorative experience just to get out there, listen to the river flow, and join with your friends who have helped save the open space that nurtured us all through the pandemic.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it. I do hope that people will participate in the public hearing on Muirfield. That is, again, July 14th. And it's a Zoom meeting. So if people go to the Wasatch County website, they can get directions there. They can also send a letter to the Open Land Board at openlands@wasatch.utah.gov.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks. Talk to you next month.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheryl Fox is the Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:51 now. Good morning. Well, the court squabbles continue as the town of Hideout fired back against a motion filed by Summit County last Friday. A press statement issued over the holiday weekend from Hideout says that Summit County's action is a publicity stunt and an attempt to create controversy where there is none. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more.
Last Friday, Summit County asked 4th District Court Judge Jennifer Brown to take action against the canvas meeting held by the Hideout Town Council June 29th, which certified Hideout residents' vote a week earlier supporting the town's annexation. Summit County requested Judge Brown add written language to support her verbal ruling declaring the annexation invalid. In response, Hideout's statement from Town Attorney Polly Samuels McLean said, quote, Hideout is shocked by Summit County's repeated bullying, mischaracterization of the facts, and attempt to subvert Hideout's citizens' rights. Summit County's motion Friday alleged that the Hideout Council's canvass defied Judge Brown's ruling, striking down the town's annexation ordinance. That ordinance annexed 350 acres of Summit County land last year without the county's consent for Hideout's plans to build a residential commercial center. In its motion, Summit County contended that Judge Brown's ruling, issued on June 22nd, the very day of the referendum, voided the annexation entirely from its inception. The county now wants Judge Brown to add written enforcement language to her ruling. But Hideout, in its weekend statement, said the judge's decision, quote, was a legal one and is subject to appeal. In the meantime, the town said, state law required it to hold the canvas meeting and officially state the voting results, confirming that the annexation was approved by a two-thirds majority of Hideout voters, and declared the annexation is in full force and effect as the law of Hideout. Hideout's statement said Summit County is trying to quash the voice of its citizens. Summit County also alleged that Utah Director of Elections Justin Lee advised Hideout not to hold a canvas, given the ruling from 4th District Court. In response, Hideout contended that Summit County selectively cited one email from Lee. The town said the Lieutenant Governor's office supported its approach. The Hideout Council's proclamation referenced Judge Brown's ruling, and the town's attorneys have given assurances they have no intention of violating the judge's ruling. Hideout's statement over the weekend said Summit County's motion is frivolous and meaningless and intended to incur higher legal fees and waste court resources. The statement also said that Summit County's declared hope to work with local cities on regional planning issues is mere lip service, as they put it. The next court hearing on the case, set for July 16th, will address scheduling and an oral ruling from the judge, which deals with Summit County's original lawsuit filed last summer. Hideout has asked for that lawsuit to be dismissed, and a decision is expected from Judge Brown. For KPCW, I'm Rick Brough.
Well, the Park City Sunday Market was the main 4th of July attraction this year for a big crowd of both visitors and locals on Main Street. KPCW's Ben Lassiter spoke with some of those who were celebrating.
People came to Old Town for the 4th of July from all over the country, and some did not find out the parade had been rescheduled until it was too late. Hattie Hawkins, who was in town from St. Louis to visit her sister, was surprised there was no parade on the 4th, but said they enjoyed spending the holiday in town all the same.
We were excited to take it in, but, you know, it is what it is. At least we still get to do this today, you know. Everybody's got, well, most people have their red, white, and blue colors on, so it's just everybody's celebrating together at least. I think it's just great seeing all varieties of people out here, and you know what? Everybody is so loving and accommodating to everybody.
Jeff and Lindsay Heath and their dog came up from Magna. They said they attend the Silly Market regularly and were just in town to enjoy the normal Sunday scene.
We just come out here for the farmer's market, come down, have some food and drinks and just support music, local. Support local, and get cool stuff for the house and take the dog for a walk. It's nice that it's not 2020 anymore. You know, like it's cool to see people walking around enjoying life again.
This year's parade was held July 2nd after City Council voted to move it to that day to minimize crowds for COVID safety and a more local experience. 35 floats, filled with locals and businesses, followed the traditional parade route for a shorter than usual celebration that still managed to enjoy perfect weather in between passing rain showers. Park City resident Travis Stagel said he liked having the parade 2 days before the 4th, because the crowd was smaller and had more familiar faces than in the past.
I think the parade is an important part of the town, and I think it gives us character. I think it brings out the locals, and it kind of shows who we are and our families and all the different organizations that are helping to just make this town so unique and beautiful. And, you know, if it's just a bunch of tourists everywhere that aren't from around here, you know, you can kind of feel like this could be done anywhere. I think the parade gives it its character, and it shows kind of who the people are that are helping take care of the town.
Alex Podwinski, also from Park City, agreed with Stagel that there were positive impacts to it being rescheduled and scaled down slightly.
You know, I think our parades had gotten to the point where we were outnumbered by 10, 15 to 1 in terms of locals, visitors, which, not to denigrate visitors, we love them and we try to keep Park City a nice place for them to visit, but from a personal perspective, even the idea of it spread out over 4 days, which was very controversial, I think was a good idea.
As for the fireworks ban this summer, all of those interviewed agreed it was worth avoiding the risk of wildfire. Also on Sunday, the city held its annual memorial service at Schurz Plaza. The ceremony honored Officer Rodney Schurz, who died after being hit by a car on July 4th, 1984. This year, city officials underscored the extra effort officers had made during the pandemic. The ceremony included the national anthem sung by a Park City lieutenant and a moment of silence and words from Chief Wade Carpenter. A few other events livened up the fireworks free long weekend, including an Air Force flyover Saturday morning, and sporting events, live music, and a fun run Sunday. Ben Lasseter, KPCW News.
Heber City residents can speak directly to public officials about plans for a city development project at a public hearing today. The public hearing will take place as part of Heber City's regular city council meeting starting at 7 o'clock and will focus on the project area and budget. The city has posted messages to its website about a 20 to 30 year vision of transforming the downtown area. In videos on the webpage entitled Envision Heber City 2050, city officials describe ideas designed to promote economic development, such as improved roads, sidewalks, and parking areas to better facilitate traffic to businesses. Matt Brower is Heber City's manager.
Become a destination place, a tourism destination where people are coming and dining and shopping, dropping the money, and then going home.
The proposal involves some 80 acres of downtown area around Main Street. Brower says the city's looking to finance this future growth using only increases in property tax revenues that appreciate in value. The city would reinvest these increases in property tax payments, which are called increments, into development within the project area.
So what we're talking about here is the increment that's going to be generated from property value increases. For over 20 years, we've got some projections that show that we'll be able to generate a certain amount of increment that will then be reinvested in the downtown, hopefully generate even more increment so that we can really turn that downtown around.
A notice has been sent to residents within the proposed area to announce tonight's public hearing. The project will not result in additional property taxes, which Brower confirms, saying that other only properties that invest to increase their values will be affected. The proposed project would spur development on and around Main Street within an 80-acre zone stretching from Airport Road to just south of 1200 North.